see for conscription, and it's C for Capitol Hill. Well, it's C for conscription, and it's C for Capitol Hill. And it's C for the Congress that passed that goddamn bill. Beautifully. I'd rather be at home, even sleeping in a holler log. I'd rather be here at home, even sleeping in a holler log, than go to the army, be treated like a dirty dog. Diddly.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's debate is, would the world be better off without religion?
Our motion is, the world would be better off without religion. And here to speak in support of the motion, A.C. Grayling, philosopher and author of the good book, A Humanist Bible.
It seems very unkind to say this, but alas, it's just basically true, that the religious outlook on the world has its roots, its origins, in the beliefs, the superstitions of illiterate goatherds who lived up to 3,000 years ago. However much religion reinvents itself, and however much it tries to make us forget its history, and however much it obscures the fact that it depends upon proselytizing very small children for its survival, despite all that, we have an opportunity to think again and afresh and to recognize that in order to live with the kind of hope, with the kind of responsibility which is essential for a world of peace, we've got to do that hard work of choosing our morality, choosing our ethics, thinking about the principles on which we live, not borrowing it, not inheriting it, not having to conform to a set of doctrines about these things and a set of rituals which people very, very, very long time ago depended upon, but to think afresh, start again, and look at this world as a place where reason and human experience have to be our best, because they are, in fact, our only guides.
Thank you, A.C. Grayling. Our motion is, the world would be better off without religion. And here to summarize his position against the motion, Dinesh D'Souza, president of the King's College in New York.
Rabbi Wolpe and I have been laboring under a tremendous disadvantage in this debate. Both our opponents have a British accent. Now, I was raised in India, and I come from a small part of India called Goa, which was a Portuguese colony. And I'd always assumed that my Christianity was the product, quite honestly, of the Portuguese Inquisition. The Portuguese came to India with a sword in one hand and a Bible in the other, and lots of people converted. They were extremely persuasive. So I'm very alert to the dangers of religion. On the other hand, I once asked my grandfather, a historian, about this, and he said that the fact of the matter was that tons of Indians flung themselves into the arms of the missionaries. They wanted to convert. Why? And my grandfather's answer was that if you look at history, it was because of the ancestral, not religious, but cultural caste system. Most of the Indians were relegated to the lower castes. And the fact of the matter is that if you were at the bottom, an untouchable, let's say, there was no way to get out. And so even though the missionaries might have been greedy and irredentist, the fact that they preached an idea of universal brotherhood, of love, of compassion, inspired people, ennobled their lives. And that's why they became Christians. A world without religion would, in fact, be a grimmer, harsher, meaner world. And that's why it's better to have a world with religion in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dinesh D'Souza. Our motion, the world would be better off without religion. And here to summarize his position in support of this motion, Matthew Chapman, writer and co-founder of Science Debate.
The world will be better off without religion because it is better off without religion. If religion made people behave better, markers of social dysfunction, drug addiction, ignorance, teen pregnancy, violent crime would be much lower in highly religious societies. In fact, the opposite is true. Forgive me for using America by way of comparison. I am American. I love America. However, 90% of Americans believe in God, but we have by far the largest prison population on earth. Drug addiction is widespread. Gun violence is grotesque. Our education system produces kids whose math and science skills are far lower than in secular countries, while our rate of teen pregnancy are far higher. And in a country so rich and Christian, it's amazing how many people live in abject poverty. Religion is irrational, morally confusing and divisive. It still denigrates women, it still fosters homophobia, and religious gave us 9/11. Making no reference to God, science has, among many other things, rid us of the plague, smallpox, and polio, dramatically reduced infant mortality, doubled the average length of a person's life, and is coming to understand how the brain works, including its capacity for empathy and moral decision-making. All this progress, all this beautiful knowledge, all this alleviation of human suffering in 100 years. Religion has had thousands of years to prove its supernatural effectiveness. It hasn't. We think it's time to try a safer and more enlightened way. So I hope you'll support our position that the world would be better off without religion. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew Chapman. Before we move forward, I just want to thank our debaters for the quality of argument and the spirit of fairness that they brought to this. And I really feel that they might not have agreed with each other, but they heard each other, and that's the essence of what we're trying to do here. So thank you to them. All right, so we have the final results. We asked you to vote before the debate and once again after the debate on where you stood on this motion and on what team you felt argued their position best. And the team whose numbers changed the most are our winner. The motion is this: the world would be better off without religion. And here is the result. Before the debate, 52% were in support of the motion, 26% were against, and 22% were undecided. After the debate, 59% support this motion. That's up 7%. 31% are against it. That's up only 5%, and 10% are undecided. That's down 12%. That means the side arguing for the motion that the world would be better off without religion has carried this debate. Our congratulations to them. Thank you from me, John Donvan, and Intelligence Squared U.S. We'll see you next time.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Rebels crush it as you will.
then the birds will sing to us, was hopping on the cotton hill. The possum on the gum tree couldn't keep his still as he went climbing on. Abraham has spoken, and the message has been sent. The prison doors have opened, and out the prisoners went to join the same army of African descent as we go marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. As we go marching on.
Coming up next, Edward R. Murrow reports on a first-hand account of what he saw at Buchenwald, April 12, 1945. Buchenwald was a Nazi concentration camp. Edward R. Murrow was an American broadcast journalist.
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening. If you're at lunch, or if you have no appetite to hear what Germans have done, now is a good time to switch off the radio. For I propose to tell you of Buchenwald. It is on a small hill about 4 miles outside Weimar, and it was one of the largest concentration camps in Germany, and it was built to last. As we approached it, we saw about 100 men in civilian clothes, with rifles, advancing in open order across a field. There were a few shots. We stopped to inquire. We're told that some of the prisoners had a couple of SS men cornered in there. We drove on, reached the main gate. The prisoners crowded up behind the wire. We entered. And now let me tell this in the first person, for I was the least important person there, as you shall hear. There surged around me an evil-smelling horde. Men and boys reached out to touch me. They were in rags and a remnant of uniform. Death had already marked many of them, but they were smiling with their eyes. I looked out over that mass of men to the green fields beyond, where well-fed Germans were plowing. A German, Fritz Gersheimer, came up and said, "May I show you around the camp? I've been here 10 years. An Englishman stood to attention, saying, "May I introduce myself? Delighted to see you. And can you tell me when some of our blokes will be along?" I told him soon, and asked to see one of the barracks. It happened to be occupied by Czechoslovakians. When I entered, men crowded around, tried to lift me to their shoulders. They were too weak. Many of them could not get out of bed. I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it. 5 to a bunk. The stink was beyond all description. When I reached the center of the barracks, a man came up and said, "You remember me. I am Peter Zenkel, one-time mayor of Prague." I remembered him, but did not recognize him. He asked about Benish and Jan Masaryk. I asked how many men had died in that building during the last month. They called the doctor. We inspected his records. There were only names in the little black book, nothing more. Nothing who these men were, what they had done, or hoped. Behind the names of those who had died, there was a cross. I counted them. They totaled 242. 242 out of 1,200 in 1 month. As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. They were so weak. The doctor's name was Paul Heller. He had been there since 38. As he walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others,
they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only 6. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. An elderly man standing beside me said, "The children, enemies of the state." I could see their ribs through their thin shirts. The old man said, "I am Professor Charles Grisha of the Sorbonne." The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We went to the hospital. It was full. The doctor told me that 200 had died the day before. I asked the cause of death. He shrugged and said, "Tuberculosis, starvation, fatigue. and there are many who have no desire to live. It is very difficult. Dr. Heller pulled back the blankets from a man's feet to show me how swollen they were. The man was dead. Most of the patients could not move. As we left the hospital, I drew out a leather billfold, hoping that I had some money which would help those who lived to get home. Professor Richer from the Sorbonne said, "I should be careful of my wallet if I were you. You know, there are criminals in this camp, too." A small man tottered up saying, "May I feel the leather, please? You see, I used to make good things of leather in Vienna." Another man said, "My name is Walter Röder. For many years, I lived in Joliet. Came back to Germany for a visit, and Hitler grabbed me. I asked to see the kitchen. It was clean. The German in charge had been a communist. I'd been at Buchenwald for 9 years. Had a picture of his daughter in Hamburg. Hadn't seen her for almost 12 years. And if I got to Hamburg, would I look her up? He showed me the daily ration. One piece of brown bread about as thick as your thumb. On top of it, a piece of margarine, as big as 3 sticks of chewing gum. That and a little stew was what they received every 24 hours. He had a chart on the wall. Very complicated it was. There were little red tabs scattered through it. He said that was to indicate each 10 men who died. He had to account for the rations. And he added, "We're very efficient here." We went again into the courtyard. And as we walked, we talked. The two doctors, the Frenchman and the Czech, agreed that about 6,000 had died during March. Kirchenheimer, the German, added that back in the winter of 39, when the Poles began to arrive, without winter clothing, they died at the rate of approximately 900 a day. 5 different men asserted that Buchenwald was the best concentration camp in Germany. They had had some experience of the others. Dr. Heller, the Czech, asked if I would care to see the crematorium. He said it wouldn't be very interesting because the Germans had run out of coke some days ago and had taken to dumping the bodies into a great hole nearby. Professor Richer said, "Perhaps I would care to see the small courtyard." I said yes. He turned and told the children to stay behind. As we walked across the square, I noticed that the professor had a hole in his left shoe and a toe sticking out of the right one. He followed my eyes and said, "I regret that I am so little presentable, but what can one do?" At that point, another Frenchman came up to announce that 3 of his fellow countrymen outside had killed 3 SS men and taken 1 prisoner. We proceeded to the small courtyard. The wall was about 8 feet high. It adjoined what had been a stable or garage. We entered. It was floored with concrete. There were 2 rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some of the bodies were terribly bruised, though there seemed to be little flesh to bruise. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. All except 2 were naked. I tried to count them as best I could, and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in 2 neat piles. There was a German trailer, which must have contained another 50, but it wasn't possible to count them. The clothing was piled in a heap against the wall. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. God alone knows how many men and boys have died there during the last 12 years. Thursday, I was told that there were more than 20,000 in the camp. There had been as many as 60,000. Where are they now? As I left that camp, a Frenchman who used to work for Havas in Paris came up to me and said, "You will write something about this, perhaps." And he added, "To write about this, you must have been here at least 2 years. And after that, you don't want to write anymore." I pray you to believe what I have said about Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words. Dead men are plentiful in war, but the living dead, more than 20,000 of them in one camp, and the country round about was pleasing to the eye. And the Germans were well fed and well dressed. American trucks were rolling towards the rear, filled with prisoners. Soon they would be eating American rations, as much for a meal as the men at Buchenwald received in 4 days. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I am not in the least sorry. I was there on Thursday, and many men in many tongues blessed the name of Roosevelt. For long years, his name had meant the full measure of their hope. These men, who had kept close company with death for many years, did not know that Mr. Roosevelt would, within hours, join their comrades who had laid their lives on the scales of freedom. Back in 41, Mr. Churchill said to me, with tears in his eyes, "One day the world and history will recognize and acknowledge what it owes to your president." I saw and heard the first installment of that at Buchenwald on Thursday. It came from men from all over Europe. Their faces, with more flesh on them, might have been found anywhere at home. To them, the name Roosevelt was a symbol, a code word for a lot of guys named Joe, who were somewhere out in the blue with the armor heading east. At Buchenwald, they spoke of the president just before he died. If there be a better epitaph, history does not record it. Thank you.
And that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. do. All right, Margie. Here comes Don. You don't have to get high to get happy. Just think about what's in store. When people start doing what they ought to be doing, then they won't be booing no more. When a president goes through the White House door, does what he says he'll do, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Silver spoon underneath that sky blue. We'll all be drinking free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew.
That's all, folks.